Speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
Thank you and good morning. Everyone who reads newspapers, magazines, or books, or watches television, knows that an ethical battle is raging in the United States, and to some extent, all over the world. Unfortunately, many on both sides of the controversy really do not understand the nature of the conflict. They seem to think that issues such as abortion, infanticide, euthanasia, genetic engineering, and suicide are the basic sources of the differences which divide us. These are vital concerns to millions of Americans, and we dare not overlook their significance. However, these are symptoms of a much more serious sickness within the body politic. Our purpose in today's discussion is to show that the basic issue is the sacredness of all human life. The supporters of abortion, euthanasia, infanticide, and similar assaults on the sanctity of life argue that their major motivation is establishing and maintaining quality of life. They apparently want only perfect human beings. There is no place in their world for children who suffer from serious illnesses, or for old people who are no longer productive. They wish to provide the right for everyone to die with dignity, regardless of the consequences of such arrangements. You can surely understand from what you have read and observed that the battle lines are clearly drawn. Christians know what is at stake, and with God's help, they are not going to compromise the Word of God, nor are they going to desert unborn babies, mentally and physically handicapped children, and the elderly citizens of our country. Christians have no choice but to fight with all the strength which our great commander provides. Paul instructs Christians in every age to put on the whole armor of God and then to stand. Ephesians 6:11-13. Let me raise some questions regarding what are commonly called single issues, which will put our topic in proper perspective. Most of you know that certain physical and mental defects can be discovered by physicians before the child is born. Down syndrome, Tay-Sachs disease, spina bifida, and other abnormalities can be diagnosed in the fetus by sophisticated techniques which are of relatively recent origin. What are parents supposed to do when they learn that their child will be affected by one of these serious problems? Do they have a moral right to decide that such a child should not be allowed to live, that it should be aborted? Do Down syndrome children serve no good purpose? Do we have a right to decide that? Who gave parents and their doctor the right to play God? Many defenders of abortion insist that a child who suffers from serious mental or physical illnesses could not lead a normal life, whatever that means, and therefore ought to be aborted. Those children could not experience quality of life. Besides, they would be a great burden to their parents and to society in general, or perhaps to both. Our financial and human resources are limited, and according to these people, will not permit us to care for these children. There will be more of the good things in life for the rest of us if we do not squander our money and our time on those who cannot have the good life anyway. And what about infanticide? That is the taking of the lives of those children who are born deformed in spite of our best efforts to have them aborted. Do we allow them to starve to death, like infant Doe at Bloomington, Indiana? Or perhaps we beat their little heads against the floor like a father did to his newborn son in Harvey, Illinois? Do we wait a few days to ascertain whether or not a child suffers from some abnormality before we declare him to be human, as has been suggested by certain American and English scientists? if all life is not sacred? What difference could any of this make? My friends, if you have listened carefully to the arguments of the pro-abortionists, you know that many of those same arguments can be applied to infanticide and to euthanasia. Let me give you an example. If parents and their doctor have the right to abort a child suffering from Down syndrome, why do they not have the same right to put that child to death if he is born with Down syndrome? Incidentally, some ethicists, like Joseph Fletcher, are agitating for the right of parents to kill their severely handicapped children. If having another child will put a severe financial strain on the family, and the mother has a right to abort her child, what could possibly be wrong with killing the child once it has been born? If the mother can morally justify abortion, how can she condemn infanticide or mercy killing? It may sound cruel, and it is unspeakably cruel, but infanticide already exists in the United States and in other countries. If we have the right, and maybe even the responsibility, to abort children which would be a financial burden to the family, do we not have the same right in dealing with old people? There are literally thousands of old people in nursing homes and in hospitals all across our country and around the world. Many of these old people do not even know who they are or where they are or that they are. They are costing their family members and the government millions of dollars. What possible good do they serve? They are not able to produce any more, and likely they never will be. Why not follow Hitler's plan and mercifully put them to death? Some humanists argue that we would be doing the old people a great favor. But I have never heard any of these older citizens make that kind of suggestion. My own father died a little over 3 years ago. He did not suffer for a great length of time. He actually died in about 10 weeks after he was diagnosed as having cancer of the pancreas. Suppose he had lingered for months or even years. It would not have taken many months to have exhausted his financial resources. Then his children would have been morally obligated, to the extent of their ability, to provide for his needs. Paul instructed sons, daughters, nephews, nieces, and grandchildren to provide for their widowed relatives, or else they would be worse than infidels. 1 Timothy 5:8. The financial burden could have been enormous, as many of you know by personal experience. Would we have been justified in requesting the doctor to remove the life support systems? His doctor would not have done so, I'm sure. Of course, we could have dismissed his doctor and obtained the services of one who would have let him die. Are there really doctors who would let a patient die? I shall mention some who would and some who have done so when we discuss euthanasia in greater detail later. If we allow some to live and some to die, on what basis do we make those decisions? Who has the knowledge and the wisdom to draw the line between those who should live and those who should die? Do the doctors have the expertise and the wisdom to make these decisions? Suppose those doctors have been trained by a situation ethicist like Joseph Fletcher. For many years, Joseph Fletcher taught medical ethics at the University of Virginia Medical School. Dr. Fletcher enthusiastically supports abortion, infanticide, euthanasia, and suicide. My friends, if I were you, I would be sure to check my doctor's credentials to see whether or not he attended the University of Virginia Medical School. If he did, I would talk to him about his ethical views. If all human life is not sacred, what would be wrong with cheating a fellow man in a business deal? If he is no more than a dog or a horse, as some evolutionists insist, why not lie to him or steal from him or take his wife and children from him? There have been dark moments in the history of our great nation when men have been treated like animals, and that with the support of our legal system. The Supreme Court of the United States upheld a Virginia statute requiring the sterilization of a young mother who had given birth to an allegedly feeble-minded child. The child had scored a mental age of 9 on the Stanford-Binet intelligence test. The child's mother had tested at the mental age of 7. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote the court's decision in Buck v. Bell. We have seen more than once that the public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives. It would be strange if it could not call upon those who already sap the strength of the state for these lesser sacrifices. 3 generations of imbeciles are enough. There is no great difficulty in understanding that kind of reasoning when you know the low view of human beings which Justice Holmes entertained. He claimed that he could see no difference for attributing to a man a significance different in kind from that which belongs to a baboon or a grain of sand. Please understand that I am not arguing that every member of the Supreme Court from the days of Oliver Wendell Holmes to the present has held these views of human life, but a significant number of them have. When a judge does not see any difference between a man and a baboon, or a man and a grain of sand, his decisions will reflect his political and judicial philosophy. Some of our current justices on the Supreme Court believe that an unborn baby deserves less protection than an American eagle or a snail darter. Until the judges of our nation come to respect and value all human life, all of us are potentially vulnerable. Later, I plan to speak on a topic of serious concern among doctors and among patients as well, that is, informed consent. Most doctors are very careful to explain what a given treatment entails, the possible complications, the chances of recovery. Unless human beings are sacred, why should they bother? We do not usually inform cats and dogs about their medical treatment. If human beings are of no greater value than a baboon, how does one justify requiring informed consent for one and not for the other? In the past several years, genetic engineering has become one of the most controversial subjects among scientists, philosophers, theologians, and others. Of course, genetic engineering has become a very common practice in the animal and plant kingdoms. Scientists seek, through various means, to improve horses, cows, sheep, dogs, and other animals. Prize cows and sheep can produce several calves and lambs in 1 year by embryo transfer. What are the moral objections, or are there any, in engineering plants and animals? If human beings are no more than sheep and cattle, why not engineer man to our own specifications, as Adolf Hitler and the German scientists were striving to do? Actually, the discussion of any ethical issue makes sense only if all human life is sacred. The Sermon on the Mount, the Ten Commandments, the fruit of the Spirit, the Christian graces, the ethics of the prophet are of great value only if men are of inherent worth, if they are creatures of Almighty God, if they are going to live forever and ever. If all men are not sacred, we have every reason to do what is right in our own eyes, if we want to. If we do not want to do what we want to do, who can fault us for that? There is an abundance of evidence that many Americans do not regard all human life as sacred. Various academic disciplines often devalue the distinctiveness and the sanctity of human life. Dr. B.F. Skinner, a behavioral psychologist of Harvard, argues for the abolition of man as individual. His abolition has been long overdue, says Skinner. Autonomous man is a device used to explain what we cannot explain in any other way. He has been constructed from our ignorance, and as our understanding increases, the very stuff of which he is composed vanishes. To man, as man, we readily say, good riddance. Dr. Skinner quotes Crutch as saying that the traditional view of man supports Hamlet's exclamation, how like a god. But Pavlov's view was, how like a dog. Skinner places human beings above dogs, but for what reason, I have not been able to discover. Dr. Francis Schaeffer, the distinguished American Swiss theologian and philosopher, summarizes the modern view of human beings. The concept of man's dignity is gone. We are in the post-Christian world. Man is junk, and man can be treated as junk. If the embryo is in the way, ditch it. If the old person is in the way, ditch him. If you're in the way, and that's where we lie today. Has Dr. Schaeffer overdrawn the situation? Please listen to all our lessons on bioethical issues and draw your own conclusions. My friends, not only are many in academia devaluing human life, so are many in the medical community. The Los Angeles Times reported that a British doctor had proposed a death pill for old people. He expressed the opinion that it might be available and perhaps even obligatory by the end of the century. He predicted that it would be necessary for the survival of the fittest. That expression, the survival of the fittest, indicates the influence that the theory of organic evolution has exerted on the thinking of this British physician. Dr. Walter Alvarez, a very prominent American physician, believes that a law will soon be passed that will leave the decision of when to pull the plug in the hands of the physician. Dr. Alvarez insists that the law would save the American public billions of dollars. He also states, it will probably be many years before we physicians in America can bring ourselves to chloroform an idiotic infant or to permit a slowly dying patient to take an overdose of medicine. What we will first have to train ourselves to do will be to leave by the patient's bed a lethal drug which he can take some night if he so desires. Modern liberal religion has been just as guilty of failure to honor God's image in man, and with less justification. Religious leaders ought to know better. Dr. Joseph Fletcher, a humanist and a professor of Christian ethics at the University of Virginia Medical School, agrees with Ashley Montague's observation that babies are not born with human nature, but only with more or less capacity to become human. Dr. Fletcher questions whether or not we may assign personal status to fetal life. The status that is usually meant when people speak of a truly human being. My friends, if we may assign truly human status to any person, we may also decide the truly human status of severely handicapped children or of permanently comatose patients. Can you see where that kind of reasoning will lead us? If human beings, rather than God, make that decision, how safe are any of us? Under these conditions, we might be eliminated if we were the wrong color, or the wrong religion, or the wrong race. Are we on a slippery slide that will eventually lead to the atrocities of Nazi Germany? If human beings have the responsibility for assigning truly human status, what standards are we going to use? Joseph Fletcher lists the following as criteria or norms for determining humanhood. First, we are truly human only if we have minimum intelligence. Fletcher arbitrarily assigns the IQ of 20 on the Stanford-Binet intelligence test. He insists that homo is indeed sapiens in order to be homo. The word homo means man, and the word sapiens means wise. The expression homo sapiens refers to a human being. What Fletcher said is very simple. Man is man only if he is wise. If he is not wise, he has no right to belong to the human family. Second, human beings must possess self-awareness. Creatures which do not know who they are cannot belong to the human family. How many very young children are aware of themselves? I have visited many old people in nursing homes who did not know who they were, or as we said a few minutes ago, even that they were. Fletcher has no moral objections to declaring unborn babies, very young babies, and old persons as non-persons. I understand that this is a very serious charge against Dr. Fletcher, but there is no question about his position on these matters. He believes that it would be in order not to declare a newborn a person until he is at least a year old. If the child has or develops severe mental or physical handicaps, he could be put to death painlessly, and no one has been harmed, since he was not assigned truly human status. Third, a person, a human being, must be able to exercise self-control. If the person cannot control himself, and the condition cannot be corrected medically or psychologically, the individual is not a person, not ethically, and certainly not in the eyes of the law, just as a fetus is not legally a person. I am told that many alcoholics and other drug addicts cannot control their own lives. Are they not persons because of a lack of self-control? Soviet Russia places dissidents in psychiatric wards in order to control their behavior. Could that happen in the United States if men like Joseph Fletcher are allowed to influence the thinking of a majority of our citizens? Fourth, we are truly human only if we have a sense of time. We Americans are very conscious of time, but there are millions of men and women who pay no attention to time. They have no sense of time. Are they less than human because of that? Small children have no sense of the passage of time. No permanently comatose person has any sense of time. Fifth, persons must have a sense of futurity. That is, they must be able to think about tomorrow, next year, and 10 years from now. Such a stipulation rules out every unborn baby, all very small children, all severely retarded persons, and a host of others. Sixth, along with a sense of futurity, human beings, to be human, must also have a sense of the past. Again, this rules out all unborn babies, all newborn babies, and thousands of old people. Seventh, those who possess personhood must have the capacity to relate to others. Fletcher believes that those who do not have this ability simply have no right to live. Eighth, we must have concern for others. In my judgment, Dr. Fletcher fails this criterion, unless, of course, you allow him to define others. Millions of otherwise intelligent people do not care for anyone except themselves. Have we the right, or perhaps the obligation, to remove these uncaring people from the face of the earth? Ninth, men and women must be able to enjoy communication. If a patient cannot hear, speak, feel, or see others, he is not truly human. 11th, we must be able to control our existence. If we cannot control our own situation, then we are not responsible persons. Irresponsible persons apparently have no right to life. 12. A human being must have curiosity. Occasionally, I have a college student who exhibits no curiosity. He seems to be unconcerned about his college studies, his future role in society, and even about his family status. If people demonstrate no curiosity, have they forfeited their right to life? I am afraid this criterion would eliminate great numbers of our fellow men. It might have gotten rid of many of us at some time in our lives. 13th, human beings must have a balance of rationality and feeling. Most of us accept the fact that a balance between rationality and feeling is desirable. We should want to be reasonable in all our activities, but we should be able to express our emotions to our families and to our friends. But do we really have to strike the proper balance between the two in order to be human? Do we know what the proper balance is? This approach to the worth of individuals is almost purely subjective. It has no validity. It places the lives of men, women, and children in jeopardy. The Lord willing, I shall continue to discuss the sacredness of all human life in our lesson next Sunday morning. If you have questions or comments, we are concerned about hearing from you. Please listen again next Sunday morning, and until then, may God richly bless you.